Okie doke, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. Ask Daniel O'Donnell if he's offended when someone impersonates him. Well, I know for a fact he's not, because he's invited people on stage to impersonate him, and I've heard him rank those that have. So I know for a fact that he isn't offended, because his actions say otherwise. Please ask Daniel to run for president. Well, as much as I could, I did. Interesting, you know, he says it's not for him, he doesn't want to do it, and it would stop him doing other stuff that he enjoys. But you can see there's a little twinkle there that perhaps if things were a little bit different, perhaps he might. I don't want to put words into the man's mouth. He spoke very clearly and ruled himself out of it, but still. A caller says, it's good to have you home always. Enjoy your time off touring. I'm so glad you can now chill out. But as he mentioned there, Daniel O'Donnell's version of chilling out is a lot of people's version of working flat out, if that makes sense. Please warn anyone travelling on the N13 Letterkenny Drumkeen Ballybofey Road. Please allow extra time, roughly 20 minutes each way. It's great to see upgrades, but the delay they cause is ridiculous. Why are these works not done at night? Well, you can probably double or triple, I don't know how it works, contracts to expect people to work through the night. Because you're asking people who you employ ordinarily in daytime hours to work through the night, and that comes at a premium. That would drive up the cost of contracts. Maybe that would mean this work doesn't get done at all. I'm not defending that situation. I'm just trying to look at the reality. It makes sense, do them at night, but you know yourself. The whole town is bad with traffic, says a caller, which always means Letterkenny. Morning, Greg. Is there a more useless organisation than the UN? What do they actually ever do? Apart from condone things and complain, they never apply forceful actions to anything. Utterly useless. Netanyahu is doing a great job of flattening the Gaza Strip for his buddy Trump, for his Riviera of the Middle East. The world is a sick, sick place. Dog eat dog. We haven't changed since the Romans. I think we're edging back the way more than we ever were. It is, you know, you have to protect yourself and you have to protect your mind, because everywhere you look, if you didn't protect yourself and allow yourself space, there seems like there's negativity, or the walls seem to be closing in. And that's why it's so important that we realise there's an awful lot of light in life as well, whilst we're not obviously empathetic, sympathetic or campaigning to help others. You do need space for yourself to breathe, to drop your shoulders, to let the back muscles loosen a little bit. Because if you didn't do that, that's why, and people criticise, that's why I watch some nonsense on telly. I don't watch the 6 o'clock news. I don't watch the 9 o'clock news. I watch nonsense. And it's just a way of sort of breaking away from it, you know, breaking away from what's going on. Greg, it's ridiculous the fuss about a man mimicking Barack Obama. Sure, on St. Patrick's Day, I see people dress up as the Pope. Don't hear anyone being offended. Yeah, it's when you go into the space of race that seems to be an issue. A caller says, not only bullying children at schools, the HSE is widespread with the bullying of adults. Now, not something I'd be privy with, but if you want to give us more information into that or what you mean by it, please let us know. Still waiting on that guest to join, Caroline, by the way, so I know you're under pressure with time. Road safety, on the issue of, my wife and young child had to sit in the road in Manor on Saturday night for 10 minutes as the roadway was blocked with diffing and the guards were notified. What's going on there? I think there needs to be a couple of weekends, or whenever the hotspots is, there needs to be a couple of weekends where maybe even actually resources are diverted to that. If there's a resources issue, you know, have a, you know, like the ghost slow days or whatever they're called. I think we in Donegal need to actually sort of say, right, what can we do over the course of a couple of weekends? And I hate to talk about cracking down and law and all that kind of stuff, but look, in the absence of that, what do we do? We need to have a couple of weekends where all resources are diverted to taking these people off the streets, because it's dangerous and people are trapped and they feel like no one's listening to them, and I certainly don't want to be part of the cohort that they feel is not listening. Hi, Greg. Bottom line, if you're over 30, it would take a substantial amount of your weekly, monthly income in order to build a minimum of pension benefits. Get your experts to comment on that, please. That comes in from Liam. Also at present, with participation rates, how much would you need for a pension of 25k per annum? We might do that again. The one thing, when I talk about pensions with pension experts, and I don't mean this badly against them, there's a lot of humming and hawing. It's never that clear, because pensions is effectively your money invested. And, you know, it goes up and down and left and right and all this kind of stuff. It's very hard to drill in and get those proper answers. I'm joined on the line now by John McAteer, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune. John, thanks so much for joining me this morning. I hope you are well.
I am indeed, Greg.
Right. As I mentioned to our listeners, soon I'm going to be joined in studio by Margaret and Paula Martin. They were victims of Con Cunningham and were this week given an apology yesterday by the Diocese of Raphoe. And I want to speak to the ladies about, I suppose, their journey to get to that apology. And it's been a long, long journey. This, of course, is a story that you've been tracking right from the get-go, John. So maybe I might get from you the background to this case, how it emerged, and you might take us through that, John.
I suppose we begin with Father Con Cunningham, being made the priest in Fanavolta, the curate, in 1970. He was there for 10 years or thereabouts. And in that time, he became very active and very involved in almost every activity, especially children's games, the community games and all of that kind of thing. And indeed, it wasn't that long after he arrived when concerns began to emerge, and they came from other parishes as well, that his behaviour in the company of young girls was unacceptable and it just wasn't good enough. But remember, we were living in an era in the 70s where people were really scared of the church. They believed in eternal hell and damnation, and the church had browbeaten them into submission.
And unfortunately, that was culture that the perpetrators of these crimes exploited. They knew what was going on.
They knew exactly what was going on. And indeed, there was a fair element of cover-up going on as well, because I was visited long before any of this came into the light of day by two clergymen to say to me, why do you not like the church? Why are you annoying us? And the words that I used to them would have been four-letter expletives. Mm. And it went on from there. And Father Con eventually would have departed in around the middle of 1980. And the rumours were there. The rumour mill was very, very strong about him. And indeed, rumours were coming in from various other parishes across the diocese where he had served. And one of the features, when you look back on it, bishops kept moving people like him and Father Eugene Green around because they knew. But they just wanted to keep they were protecting the church rather than anything else. And this is one of the awful things to emerge from the Martin sisters, who were first abused in the early 1970s. And now this week, they're finally getting that apology. I first of all to congratulate both of them, because they have stayed with it. They have lived through very dark and very shocking times. And I would have known all about it. The first contact they made with me officially was in some days before Christmas in 2019. And I met with them within that week before the paper was published again at the beginning of January. And it was the most harrowing case that I have ever sat and listened to. They had a statement prepared for me, very well prepared. It didn't need any alterations. I just sat there frozen. I think maybe 3 to 4 hours in Kirriekeel. And you could feel their pain and their hurt, but you could not quite equate that to why they were abused and why the church had stayed silent and why they'd done nothing about it. It is absolutely shocking and disgraceful, and it still is to this very day, because the church, back in those days, they just simply controlled the flock. Lock, stock and barrel.
Can you recall when the sisters first came forward or made, let the church know what was happening to them and how they were treated or how their reports were dealt with?
Well, that was 1994. Bishop Seamus Hegarty was here. It was some time before he departed for the Derry Diocese. They met at some considerable length with Bishop Hegarty, from what I recall him telling me at the time. And the main thing was that he reassured them and reassured them again and again that he believed every last word that they were saying. But unfortunately, nothing more happened then for 8 years. Now, it's that gap that's not really, it's a grey area. There are reasons for it. I'm not going to go into specific details here on the radio. But at the end of the day, when you're advised by the bishop you have to accept that what he's telling you is actually true. It was not at the top of anybody's agenda in clerical in the clerical arena.
Do you know do you know if these were the first allegations that have been made against Cunningham in 94?
I'm not too sure of that. And, we have never found that out.
And immediately after, you know, the problem is, and you can see it, it's recognised in the Diocesan press release, there were so many opportunities, firstly, to give the sisters justice, but to protect other children. And, you know, the relevant authorities weren't told, people were moved around, things were covered up. Thankfully, I hope those things can't happen now. But rather than sort of, this person was almost enabled and must have felt empowered to do whatever the hell they liked.
Absolutely, because he had the cover of community games, underage girls football, table tennis, various other things like that. And he had won over the parents. They could see no wrong. And I feel so, so sorry for them, because the lots of them are still alive. You know, to them, he was just God. He was so hardworking. Mm. But we were aware of that in the mid-1970s. For, I'm not going to repeat on the airwaves what we saw, what we heard. But, you know, in 2002, Bishop Hegarty was gone. Nothing was done for the Martins. Absolutely nothing. They had laid down red lines for Bishop Hegarty, and that was a full and frank apology from Father Cunningham that he'd be removed from ministry, which was not going to happen until 2002. He was in Falkara at that point. But the shocking thing was that he was removed from ministry and just moving away from the Martin sisters for a minute, just to show you what was going on in the church. Bishop Hegarty went to Derry. Bishop Philip Boyce came here. That was October 94. End of June 95, Bishop Philip Boyce came here. His first ever appointment as a bishop. He was from one of the orders. And he was consecrated in, I think, October, late September. So a lot had happened. And all of a sudden, there was three bishops altogether involved here. You had Bishop Hegarty, you had Bishop Boyce, and then this was left, unfortunately, to another new bishop to try and deal with it. But in the meantime, Father Conn was out of sight, out of mind. He was removed from ministry in Falkara. I remember dealing with that on behalf of the people of Falkara. He was missing for numbers of weeks. And at that time, their big worry was that they might be losing. See, at a stage, Falkara was only a curacy in the Gorta Hurk parish. And I followed that up and I heard a few things that made me worry about it. And after some years, I discovered the real truth was that Father Cunningham was sent back to Carrick, where he was born and lived, to reside beside the national school in a small council house. And within days, they discovered that his behaviour was bizarre, as they put it. Bizarre. He was in the playyard organising young girls to play games and giving them bags of chocolate. And fair play to the community in Carrick and to numbers of individuals who set up their own observation committee. And that meant that they had to observe him school hours, morning, playtime, and all of that. It split the parish to a certain extent. And then on one occasion, a member of the community was attending a meeting in Letterkenny, where he met with a superintendent from Letterkenny, and talk got around during a break, and he relayed the issue about Father Conn and the concerns, and the superintendent's eyes just rolled, and he said to the man, "Do you know something? We have some details on that man in the Garda station, and we'll go up there and look for it when the meeting is over," which they did, and there on Father Conn's file in red letters was that he was a risk at the higher end of the scale of abusing again. Now, that was how they handled that. Bishop Alan McGuckian had to come in here, and now we have Monsignor Kevin Gillespie trying to deal with it to the best as they can. And I can't offer any criticism of Kevin Gillespie, because all he can deal with is what he has in front of him. What he doesn't have is the information that some of us were provided with as journalists. And that's what worries me.
Or some answers as well as to what really was going on, who decided not to report it to the correct authorities, or was it an oversight? Who decided to move people around? You know, because...
The bishops move people around.
Yeah, they did it all the time.
Yeah.
No, I know it was they, but what was actually fundamentally going on there? I mean, people will draw their own conclusions. It's just that Margaret and Paula came forward for a reason in 1994, and this was to protect other children.
Yeah.
And we know about some, and we know, and we don't know about others who, despite their best efforts and consistent efforts, this person was left in a position to continue to do this to other people. So if I were told by a bishop in 94, I believe you, I trust what you're saying, but that person then is still given the platform to exploit other children, that would ring very hollow with me. And it took them again to come forward, again, enough is enough, to try and get this person away from vulnerable children. And when I say vulnerable children, any child is vulnerable to an evil person like this, by the way. I'm not talking using the word vulnerable children in some context. It could be moved. And then we are to presume now that safeguards are in place, and I presume we can trust to ensure something like this can't happen again. But I'm so conscious that this person was so prolific, potentially, John, that there are those, and I'll give some advice lines out a little later on, you know, that are probably still privately dealing with this person's actions.
I know that. I'm hearing from people. I talked to a man last week who was a key figure as a representative of the abused, and that is Michael Gallagher, or Martin Gallagher from Gortahurk, now living in Falkara, and he's living with that to this very day. And so are many others. From time to time, you'll get a flurry of calls. And just one example, I mean, I was accosted at Port Salon Beach in about, 1995? No, 1975. That was 1975. And that, as a journalist, I was doing nothing to exploit or to inform the public about Father Cunningham's behaviour. And around 95, that same person came to me to apologise and said it was endemic in Fannet, and that her own family had been victims of it, and they were afraid. They were afraid of their lives, that they'd have to appear in court. Now, the sad thing about this here, I just have to be very clear about this and very specific about this. A complaint can only be made by the complainant that's accepted by the Gardaí. This is the fault line. Now, the possibility is that those people who made the complaints were left in a grey area there. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty certain that the Martin sisters were not to blame for that. In fact, I'm absolutely certain. They were given to understand that, with the words that were used, no, we will look after that for you. Whilst, in fact, the exact opposite was the case. Now, you can imagine Father Philip Boyce arriving in for half the spending his life in Rome. The audits were ongoing around that 2010, 2011 time. There was very little been thrown up in the audits from Ian Elliott's year, more than a year in Donegal. The abuse was endemic, but the cover-up was absolutely scandalous. And to this very day, people will say to me, what have you against the clergy? You're writing about them. You're accusing them of clerical sex abuse. I have nothing against them, only to tell the truth, which they have failed to do. Now, we have moved on from that, as you said. We hope that we have moved away from that. But that stain is still there. Fannet seemed to have, and there's a couple of other parishes where Father Conn spent 8 and 9 years, for nothing really happened. But Fannet has that stain of clerical sex abuse. And the only redeeming factor for me was that when I put that story in the paper, the support was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It came from everywhere. Mm-hmm. But on top of that came complaints from everywhere else. And all I could do was counsel those people, because I had done a bit of that when I worked at St. Connell's. Mm-hmm. But if my first advice to them was to make tracks for the local Garda station, and you'll be received with a sympathetic ear. Make your complaint.
Yeah, a couple of people are texting in. You know, one example, government media, are they not taking responsibility? Why did John not report to the Garda the information he had? Well, I'm literally, as we speak right now, in communication with two individuals on social media, trying to offer them support and a bit of guidance. you cannot, on someone else's behalf, go and report information. That just simply is not how it works.
No, that's totally wrong. That caller said, "Why didn't I go and support or talk to the guards?" That has been very presumptuous. The guards were spoken to on several occasions and they were very sympathetic and they were giving their own advice. Advise those people to come and talk to us. They have nothing to fear. But if you're paralysed with fear and you've been abused and you have to live with that, you can understand that very, very clearly.
And you can't
clearly
re-traumatise that person or make that person a victim again. I mean, it's up to them.
I mean, that story on the 2nd of January 2020 was the first time that something went into the public domain. Mm. Now, I done that on the basis and in trust of Paula and Margaret Martin in their home at Christmas time. And I had no compulsion at all. I didn't contact anyone. I accepted what they told me was the gospel truth. And to this day, I have trusted them and I know now that they've been vindicated and cleared and they've received their apology. Okay. And I congratulate them on the heroic efforts down the years to try and live with it and to cope on the huge shadows. Because remember, you're living in an era now where people are a bit more open, but not as much as you might think.
No. There's an awful lot going on. There's a recent case where, unfortunately, another member of the clergy is before the courts, and the court's been told that it's not maybe one person they were in contact with or two person, that potentially there could be over 60 victims, and that's in the modern church. John, listen,
The abusers were prolific. They just abused wherever they went, and the church dealt with it by just turning a blind eye or moving them on when the bishop was pressurised. But like at this point, the Martins have released the details of their story.
And John, I'm going to bid you farewell because Margaret and Paul is going to be joining me in studio very shortly. Thank you so much for helping us give the background to this story for those who may not be aware. And it's shocking and it needs to be a lesson that things like this cannot ever, ever happen again, be it in the realm of the church or other areas where potentially adults could abuse the position of trust or power. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Take care. And well done, by the way, in what you've done for not just the sisters, but actually other victims of these horrendous crimes. I'm joined in studio now by Margaret Martin. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining us. And also Paula Martin. Paula.
Morning.
Thank you for coming in to us. How are you feeling this week? I suppose you knew this was coming, right? But I'm on about in terms of actually that apology out there. Paula, I'll ask you first, if that's all right.
Yesterday, listening to your show, I was relieved. I said, this is finally coming to the end for us, because this is what we wanted. All along, we really wanted this. This was really important to us. And so therefore, it was like completion, the beginning of the completion.
And that's it, because, you know, whilst one would hope that this, I think as you phrased it yourself, allows the wounds to begin to heal, that's a road you've yet to walk in reality, isn't it? Margaret, I just can't imagine what it must have been like. And of course, when I talk about things that are personal, I take the guidance from the guests. And if there's any inappropriate questions, you just literally move on, because this is your story. But I'd just be curious if you want to talk about how much sort of courage it took to, in 1994, to come forward in the first instance, and what your expectations were in doing so.
It took huge courage. But I think that I found the courage in having watched Paula struggle as she tried to come to terms with what had happened for a number of years before that. And I actually was very concerned that I was going to lose her. Mm. And so that gave me the courage at that point to accompany her. And she had been receiving help and counselling to support her to come forward. So that was where the courage began. And I expected a conversation after that. I didn't expect silence. And I think that's where the wound with the church began, because it was complete silence.
Paula, I can only imagine when you're sort of processing an experience and getting to this point and the build up to it and what your expectations might be, that it must feel like a continuation of abuse when you put yourself out there to a person in a position of authority and you would hope trust, and then, as Margaret mentioned, silence.
It was just kind of unbelievable. We kind of waited, and then, as John said, Bishop Hegarty was moved. So that was kind of the first shock, and then there was a space. And nothing happened. We said, okay, there's no bishop there to take. And then Bishop Boyce came along and said, we waited. And in the middle of that, you know, we were getting on with our lives. But I just want to go back to one thing about 1994. Mm. As difficult as it was to go there. And you know, for younger people, 1994 was a very different time. And that's only 30 years ago, but a lot has changed, especially around this whole area of child sexual abuse. Yep. And when we went there, Bishop Hegarty did not say to us, I believe you. He didn't say he didn't believe us, but he didn't say, I 100% believe what you're saying.
Right. Which is important, yeah.
So, you know, there's a slight, just that difference is that... That's there. And the other thing is that we did not know until very recently that Con Cunningham in 1994 admitted to what he had done.
Okay.
We had no idea, and it came as quite a shock to us that he admitted then, because we thought that he hadn't. And so that was that's just one thing that I just want to...
massive, really, isn't it? Because it then wasn't necessarily that you weren't listened to. Mm. The facts were out there and decisions were made with far more knowledge and sources.
And he was also sent for assessment. And we weren't aware of any of those things. Mm. But the church of that time had the pieces of information from us. Then they also knew that because he admitted to it, and whatever the results were of assessments, it wasn't that they weren't, that they didn't have solid information. Mm. And I think that was a real shock to Margaret and myself, that we only discovered recently. Mm. That the admission, I think that was horrendous. It was really... You talk about another wound, it really was a wound to listen to that they actually knew.
What element of that hurts so much, Paula? I mean, it's obviously obvious, right? But I just want to make sure we fully understand why that would compound the abuse so much.
Total disrespect for Margaret and myself and the story we told. Dismissal and the arrogance of it. Mm.
Okay.
It was hard to listen to.
So in the intervening years from 94, as we move forward in the time, like Margaret, did like months run into months, or and then months run into years? Like what were you getting back from the church or from any authorities in relation to this opening up that you had in 1994 for yourselves? But presumably you would imagine that instantly this person is removed, that no one else could ever endure, you know, what his former victims had to endure. What was happening? Was there any communication? And did time, you know...
Yes, months became years and there was silence. And all through that time, certainly there was an expectation that we would be contacted. And when Bishop Boyce took over, we hoped that he would then pick up the file and contact us, and that some action would be taken. So in all of those years of silence, really, we just were left doubting, what point there had been really in coming forward and disclosing this information. And did the church really take the welfare of the children of the diocese seriously?
Just picking up on the information that you learned relatively recently that Con Cunningham had admitted early on in this process. It's not referenced in the press release from the diocese. They referenced that time that, you know, you were believed. Would you have liked to have seen a reference to the church having that information in the mid-90s in the apology? Or does that not matter? Not really, everything matters, but you understand in the wider scale of things.
Sorry, I'm just in the apology?
Yes, I just note that they reference that, you know, you were not informed that you were believed, but you actually weren't even informed that the person responsible had admitted. It just would have been an interesting inclusion in that apology. But I'll move on from that. That's just my observation.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. What is the next interaction then from the first interaction in 1994, the next big date that you would sort of see on this
it was 2002. Mm. And then the files, it was requested that all files from the diocese be handed over to the Gardaí. And again, I got a phone call, Margaret didn't, I got a phone call to say that this was happening, and about two or three days later I got a call from the Gardaí, and within a day or two we were both being interviewed by the Gardaí, and then we would return to the church and have an interview with them, and then we were back to the Gardaí station. So in a period of 3 weeks we were going from Gardaí to the church, Gardaí to church. You know, we were two mothers. We had to get up and go to work every day. So it was very traumatic time. I think I really felt re-traumatised again because I had no preparation. I had no support. I had been to counselling up until 2001, I think. So I had left counselling, so I was beginning just to find my feet on my own. And so therefore I was really traumatised by this. I was frightened because I didn't know where it was going. Mm. I didn't know what the next step was. Mm-hmm. I had no control of this because I had no input into the decision to hand these files over. So, and I know Margaret was the same. We were both in Garda stations talking about very detailed things that were extremely difficult.
And
without support.
Exactly. You would hope now things would be different even in that area.
Yeah.
Because that is, whether the intent is there or not, and I'm sure there was no intent from the Garda, but that is re-traumatising. No support, no safety net, no... no deep dive into if this was affecting your welfare at that time.
No. It was new to them. It was new to the Gardaí. I mean, this was a new development. So they were probably trying to grapple with that as well, without having maybe people trained properly. I mean, I'm not taking away from anyone that we spoke to, but I don't think they were prepared for that type of activity as well, or interviews.
Between now and then, would you have known the location or movements of Cunningham? I would imagine what happens if I walk into a shop and this person is there. Was that part of the process as well, Margaret?
Yes. I mean, after 2002, really, we didn't really want to know where he was. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to know anything more about him. We really wanted him to be out of our lives and out of our memory. But yes, there was always a background concern if you saw somebody of that shape anywhere in the distance. You know, there was a sharp intake of breath.
It
was like, you know, so it never really went away. It was present always.
But again, in that second interaction, obviously, with the church, the motivation was to ensure that other children could not be abused by this person.
Absolutely. And I think, unfortunately, at that point, we were kind of left between two bodies with absolutely no support. So therefore, we sank because we weren't in a place really where we were fit to actually take a case. And without being fit to take a case, there wasn't any case. So that was a very difficult.
But because of case. Because of what you two did, he did admit in a more formal way his responsibility, and also resigned. But we heard from John that that's not the whole story as well. But from a church perspective, that he couldn't be in our position of trust within the church to do this to anybody else.
Yeah.
Was that seen as a hollow victory, a big victory, or were you so traumatised with what you're going through at that time you weren't able to sort of process it, or Paula?
I think we were naive at the time when I look back, and I think we were naive because I was 100% sure that the church was going to deal with this, that they were going to deal with this properly, because now they knew the act. Actually, we requested in 2002 that Con Cunningham be confronted, because to date, for us, until 2002, I felt it was our word but our word was just, you know, we didn't have a confirmation that he had admitted to this prior to 2002. We weren't aware.
Yeah.
So in 2002, it was really important. I wanted him, we both wanted him confronted, so that they would say, yes, okay, now we, you know, he said this, we know this, this has happened. So I was convinced that they would look after it. I really thought, okay, we've done enough.
But it's unimaginable that he wouldn't. This is some of the, outside of murder and what have you, these are some of the most heinous things any human person could be responsible for.
Yeah.
So you do everything you can, surely.
Surely, yeah.
But there was something cultural that, whatever it is, maybe it was a general view of children at that time or something, that the shock and awe of these accusations, stuff didn't kick in that would, you would hope would kick in regular society.
Yeah.
You decided, according to their statement, and I just want to make sure, as they phrased it, as the diocese phrased it, it's the truth, you decided at that point that you didn't want to proceed further with a criminal complaint. Is this in the knowledge that you'd...
That we had done enough.
And that something else would happen, that you wouldn't have to go through this, because this would be another re-trauma, you know, going through trauma again for you guys.
Well, I just felt at that, in 2002, in terms of my recovery and my mental health, I couldn't, and I know, hand on heart, I had two young babies at home. I knew that I could not go down this road, because my children, my boys, would lose their mother in the process. And there was no way I was going to let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
My boys now were my priority. And being the best mother I could be was my priority. And I couldn't risk a deterioration in my mental health at that time. I couldn't. I know I wouldn't have survived.
No one could expect you to. I mean, it's astonishing. Yeah, I get you 100%.
And I couldn't. And we genuinely thought we had done enough. We really genuinely thought. But later, maybe after maybe 20 into maybe 2015, 16, we were getting little bits of information that really, we were getting concerned about maybe what had not happened and what we thought would have happened in terms of monitoring Con Cunningham, who was an extremely difficult man.
Very manipulative too, by the sounds of things. It's not only what monitoring might not have been happening, it's what could happen as a result of him not being monitored. Yeah. And that is, which has, I think, been a core of all of this, is, you know, not only for yourselves, but to prevent any other children. And you weren't given, enough was not happening, especially after you went through this twice and more.
Yeah.
Enough wasn't being happening to ensure this could never happen to another child. Yeah. The most unthinkable. Then, what happened then, Margaret, whereby you felt that the time was right, or you had to engage criminally again in this process?
Well, the very brave person who came forward in 2018 and took the first case made it really clear to us that we couldn't stay silent any longer. that we had to add our voice to this story. And we could no longer be silent and hope that the church were fulfilling their role, because it felt obvious that they weren't. So we actually went to John first, John McAteer, and thank you, John. He didn't question us. He trusted that we were telling the truth and trusted our story, and he printed it. And we really hadn't thought through what steps we were taking. Yeah. All we wanted was to say, you know, this also happened to us. And so the process really began after that then. We really had to go back and relook then at where we were going to go. And that then began really the criminal procedures. Process,
which eventually ended up in a sentence.
Yeah.
Mm. 2021.
Mm. And what was your reaction to that sentence, Paula?
Well, I suppose it was relief.
Mm.
That there was just a little edge, that we knew this is only dealing with one piece of the injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we walked out of the court that day and we looked at each other and we said, this is part one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is done. And we agreed that we would give ourselves a bit of space and time to sort of just get a break from what had happened. And we didn't have to wait too long. I would say about 2 months, and we were saying, yeah, we need to do something.
Batteries
now
are charged. Let's crack on with part two.
We have to do something else, because there's still a huge piece for us, and that was the hurt that was inflicted on us from the church, from their lack of...
Multi-generational.
Yeah.
From kids to teens to 20s to 30s to 40s. It was,
lifetime.
You know, just re-hurting.
Yeah. So we decided, we had no idea how we were going to do the next part. There was no cases to look at.
No process to follow.
There was no process to follow. So we were really stepping into something very different, and we had no idea. So we went first to a solicitor, and we went to Caldwell and Robinson, and we spoke to a girl there called Kira, and then she left the firm very shortly after we went, and then we spoke to somebody else, and then we were trying again, and then a lady called Rowena Conlon walked into that company, and she got us.
Mm-hmm.
She understood, and I think what she understood is she understood the pain that we were still carrying. Mm-hmm. She had done a lot of work with the redress board mm-hmm. prior to that. So none of this was new to her.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew we had the right person. So,
And the statement released from the diocese, is it everything you could have wanted in sort of recognising in the timelines, the failures, what was gotten wrong, what you were putting through, and beyond what the church got wrong, what the church put you through in some of their actions, i.e. for thrusting you into the criminal process and all of that kind of stuff. There's a lot in there, Margaret. Do you feel now this genuinely is that part two, that you can sort of, you know, do a bit of media, and this is very important for other people, by the way. Now you've set a pathway. You talked of the pathway not being there, Paula, mm-hmm. for this process. You've set that now. But is the statement complete, Margaret, as far as you're concerned?
Yes, I do think it's complete. Mm. And I think that it has really covered the timeline from the beginning, and the apology is covering all of that time. And I really feel that it speaks from the heart. And at the end of the process that we had, which was very difficult, but actually also very, beneficial, mm-hmm. that I finally felt understood, mm-hmm. and that the church understood why the wound had remained all this time, and the importance of engagement. So yes, mm. I do feel that it has come from the heart, and that for my heart is really important.
I know you thank so many people in your statement, and I mean, I think the greatest thanks has to go to you two as well, because there are victims that you've given a voice to, or given a face to, your normal people, that people can be believed and should be believed. People should come forward. There's no doubt, I would hope that you've, whilst it should have been more with better actions from the church, you've prevented other people going through what you went through, and pulled the curtain back so that there's a level of transparency now that we can hope that something like that can never, ever happen again. Now, you did that having gone through the most horrible experience of a lifetime, but that is you can't quantify the positive impact you've had in this area through what you've gone through, because I think it's going to be far greater than we could articulate.
Well, certainly we hope so. Mm. And I just would also just like to acknowledge that it took bravery for the bishops and for Father Kevin Gillespie to engage in the process as well, because we were listened to, and some of that listening was very hard for them.
Mm. And you were listened to, but you were heard. You listened to it in the past, this time you were heard.
And we were heard. And as Margaret said, we were understood. Mm. But it did take bravery on their part, and I just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And that bravery on their part led to a process with the best possible outcome that we could imagine. And when they read that apology to us, there wasn't one word in it that we asked them to change.
Okay. So they got it. They got what needed.
So they got it. Yeah. And we were overwhelmed by the genuineness of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think then they fully understood how important it was to us.
Okay.
So it has brought a peacefulness to us,
mm-hmm.
after a long time. Yeah. But yes, and that is really important for people to hear.
Yeah.
Anyone that is suffering in silence,
mm-hmm.
I think they might be heard in a different way if, yes. they come forward. And if one person can do that, I genuinely think that there has been a shift, and we felt that shift from all of the time in our engagement with the church to now. I said we certainly have felt that there has been a shift.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a different world. Sorry, Margaret.
No, I just like to add that, you know, the process provided a very safe, mm-hmm. place,
mm-hmm.
and it was a safe place for all of us to be. And Hannah Carney, who was the mediator, you know, was very capable in that space to, yeah. provide that, a place of possibility.
I hope, and having listened to you, because life is complicated, I really do hope, and I get a sense now, as you said in your statement, that you are now in a place that allows healing to finally close the wounds, not just, yeah. for you, but everyone affected by you.
Yeah.
You know, your family's looking,
yeah.
on. Your sons who'd want to be able to move
the
world.
And their mother is still alive.
Yeah, and you know, sons that would like to move, take everything from you because they love you so much, and hopefully, yeah. now they can all get, because everyone's affected by something like this.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate you coming in, and I just want to let people know, by the way, and I know the ladies are encouraging this as well, that you can, because of the work that these people, these two ladies in front of me have done, there are mechanisms and supports in place, and they're part of a movement of people that ensured that there's you know, more transparency and what have you. You can report a concern or complaint of child abuse, either current or historical, to Margaret Northage, the designated liaison person for the diocese, Tusla, the Gardaí, and we've got details of free counselling services. I understand for some that this might be bringing up memories of their own childhood that they might be, you know, facing for the first time or what have you. And there's a great responsibility in relation to that as well. So if there's any assistance that we can give, please give us a call if we can signpost or whatever that might be. But for now, thank you both for A,
thank
coming
you
in.
For having us.
Thank
and
you very
and
much,
B, for
Greg.
Everything that you've put on the line yourselves for that's hopefully, well, we know it's helped others as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the 9 till noon show for today. The news is going to be a little late. I just want to thank Margaret and Paula Martin once again, and we'll be back tomorrow morning at 9.